Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is a conversation recorded in 1978 between legendary economist Friedrich Hayek and Tom Hazlitt, then a graduate student in economics. During the conversation, the two have an informative and thoughtful discussion of economic and social trends and monetary theory. We hope you enjoy today's podcast and stop by each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Among contemporary social philosophers, I think it's safe to say that you have pursued the idea of a spontaneous order the furthest. I'd like to ask, what is the litmus test for deciding whether some specific action of government is part of a spontaneous order, or rather an attempt to impose a solution by construction?
I think whether the government merely enforces abstract rules of conduct or makes people serve particular concrete ends. The enforcement of abstract rules of conduct, in the sense of which a general law is equally applicable to all, they only determines the formation of a type of structure without deciding anything about the purposes which men ought to aim. If men are told what end to serve, it's no longer a spontaneous order. It becomes an organization serving a particular purpose.
Now, you give the Roman Constitution as an example within a legal setting of a spontaneous evolutionary process. Yet, at any particular time during the period when the Roman Constitution was developed, it was certainly imposed upon the citizens. Isn't this type of situation a paradox?
No. I think it's not appropriate to speak of a Roman Constitution at all. The form of government was changing all through the process, and constitution is a method determining the organization of government. I was speaking about the evolution of private law, which under the Roman tradition determines the extent of the coercive powers of government. And this law developed in that sense spontaneously that the judges tried to articulate in words and judgments, moral conceptions which had gradually grown up, constantly improving them and even modifying them in order to make them internally more consistent. But it was a process of growth like this, of what essentially is a system of rules of individual conduct, which a tradition made people accept as the limitations of governmental power over, I can't say the individual, I must say the free individual, because you had a large population of slaves, which was not included. But so far as a free citizen of Rome was concerned, affected for the, say, the first 300 years of since Christ, the classical period of the Roman Empire, you could say that the powers of government were effectively reduced to what is my ideal, because it was the spontaneously developed system of rules of conduct which all that government could enforce, apart from taxation, which I will leave out for the present moment.
Mm-hmm. What mistakes in terms of the available state of knowledge did the authors of the United States Constitution make?
Or entrusting both the function of government and the function of legislation in the true sense to a single body of, in fact, two houses of Congress, who both can lay down rules of conduct and instruct government what to do. And once you have this situation, you no longer have a government under the law, because those who govern can make for themselves whatever law they like.
Many theorists have commented that your writings, political philosophy, are much more in the tradition of James Madison than they are in the tradition of Thomas Jefferson.
Perfectly correct.
What differences do you perceive along these lines?
Oh, Madison was essentially concerned in limiting government. Jefferson was much more concerned in making government do good.
In the Constitution of Liberty, you chart the divergence of liberalism in the 19th century into a libertarian wing and a socialist wing. Of course, in the 20th century, the socialist wing has been overwhelmingly dominant. But is it possible at this late date, however, that liberalism is again splitting into two schools, and that now we are seeing the reemergence of a classical liberal tradition?
I hope so. I mean, amongst the young people, certainly in last 5 or 10 years, this has been springing up, not only in the United States, also in the European continent, and in the last few months, even in France, the country which I thought was least hopeful, a group of young people who are libertarians with a well-founded intellectual argument, appreciating the points we have just been discussing, that the power of government should be limited on the one hand to enforcing rules of individual conduct, and on the other hand, without coercive powers, rendering certain services. I like to say that when I was very young, only the very old people still believed in that kind of liberalism. When I was in my middle age, nobody except myself and perhaps Mises believed in it. And now I've lived long enough to find the thing is being rediscovered by the young. That makes me fairly optimistic, not for the near future, because it will take 20 years or so before these young people will have any power. But my other phrase is, if we survive these next 20 years, if politicians don't destroy civilization, I think there's good hope for mankind.
Along those lines about how possible it is to turn back the flood of government regulation, in California we've seen a massive groundswell of opinion on this thing called Proposition 13. Yet now it seems that this tax-cutting measure will leave as its chief legacy, besides cutting property taxes, the imposition of rent controls in many parts of the state of California. It seems that the dynamics of the welfare state are very much involved in this. Do you think that it really is possible to turn back the tide?
I hope so. I'm by no means certain, but I devote all my efforts. All my concern is to operate on public opinion in the hope that public opinion will sufficiently change to make such a development possible. But if I may say so, I hope you don't are not offended. I don't believe the ultimate decision is with America. You are too unstable in your opinion. And if opinion has been turning in the right direction the last few years, it may be turning in the wrong direction again in the next few years. While it's sometimes a great advantage to be able to change opinion very rapidly, it also creates a certain amount of instability. I think it must become a much more general movement, and for that reason I'm rather more hopeful about what is happening among the young people in Europe nowadays than what's happening here. Perhaps also because in Europe the intellectual tendencies are more likely to capture public opinion lastingly, while that at present you have an equally promised group of young intellectuals in this country does not mean that in 10 years' time they will have gained public opinion.
Do you have any examples in mind of countries that have once, having flirted with socialism or the welfare state, have been able to reinstitute the rule of law?
Oh, very clearly Germany after World War II. Although in that case it was really the achievement of a single man almost.
Ludwig Erhard.
Ludwig Erhard, yes.
Let's take a look at the spontaneous order idea in terms of a specific issue. In this country, the affirmative action program has to do with racial quotas.
Explain to me what it means. I never understood what affirmative action really is supposed to mean.
Well, it's founded on the argument that if the government treats everyone equally now in terms of race, that it will implicitly be sanctioning past discrimination. Mm-hmm. Hence, it is necessary for the state to take so-called affirmative action, and for private employers to take affirmative action in hiring minorities and groups that the government classifies as having been discriminated against, and favoring them over groups that have been classified as not having been discriminated against.
Achieve non-discrimination by discrimination.
Well, that's exactly the question that has been posed by this.
Yeah.
But the question from your political philosophy, doesn't the spontaneous order idea, which is to let things work themselves out, mm-hmm. inherently favor or inherently bias, let's say, the outcome in favor of past discriminations or past inequities.
It accepts historical accidents, but after all, civilization rests on the fact that people are very different, both in their location and their gifts and their interests. And unless we allow these differences to exist, irrespective of whether we, in the particular case, think they are desirable or not, I think we stop the whole process of evolution. I mean, after all, the present civilization rests on the fact that some people have settled in places which are not very conducive to their welfare. Some people have been moving to parts of the world where conditions are not very good. And that we are using this great variety of opportunities, which means variety of opportunities means always difference of opportunities. I think if you try to make the opportunities of all people equal, you would eliminate the main stimulus to evolution. Well, let me put it to what I want to say a moment ago. What you explained to me about the meaning of affirmative action is really the same dilemma which all egalitarianism achieves. In order to make people equal, you have to treat them differently. If you treat people, so far as government is concerned, alike, the result is necessarily inequality. You can have either freedom and inequality, or unfreedom and equality.
I'd like to go to a different line of thought. Many philosophers right now, and economists, are concerned with the bias of democracy towards big government. The idea is that subsidies which go to powerful special interests, which are very specific, and the taxes and higher prices that are caused by this, the costs of government programs, are diffused over a wide audience of consumers and taxpayers, so that it is in the interests of the lobbies of special interests to go ahead and spend money to get these favors from the state, whereas it's not in the interest of consumers or taxpayers to organize on one specific issue. Now, this is somewhat different than your reasoning about the growth of government in the road to serfdom and the intellectuals and socialism. In that you basically attribute the rise of big government to a misunderstanding or a mistake that socialism really does not deliver what it promises. And here these people are saying that, that actually the tendency towards big government is a rational process in the sense that people act in their own self-interest here. How do you reconcile these two views?
Well, they are two different things, but which operate in the same direction. So far as people act under socialist influence, they work in to that aim. But what I did not fully understand at that time is that the democratic process, quite apart from socialist ideology, has the same tendency, I should strictly say, the unlimited democracy. Because an unlimited democracy is not guided by the agreement of a majority, but is guided by the necessity of buying the support of sufficient number of small groups as to form a majority. That's a very different thing. The original conception of democracy is that people actually agreed on governmental action. And it was assumed that on each issue there was a majority view and a minority view. The fact is, of course, that doesn't work that way. You have to build up a majority which then acts. And you build up a majority and canon the present system of unlimited powers of the government only by granting special privileges to a sufficient number of small groups. Now, that is another thing I had clearly seen at the time of writing The Road to Serfdom, but the main theme of the present book I'm now publishing, which the final volume is now in the press and coming out early next year, that I think that so long as we have a so-called democratic or representative legislature, which at the same time can legislate and govern, we no longer have a limited government, but rather a government which, because it is unlimited, is forced to grant ever-increasing number of special privileges to particular groups. And what originally democracy aimed at is only possible in a limited democracy, where government is under the law, and where therefore two different bodies, must be concerned in laying down the law on the one hand and operating under that law on the other.
Institutionally, how does separating these two different legislative functions, how does that make it more difficult for special interests to influence legislation? I mean, don't lobbyists then just have to buy two lunches?
Well, no. Certain things become wholly impossible. If you can use coercion only in the execution of general rules, certain things are completely impossible. Government just would not have the power to grant special privileges, and that will become clear if the thing has to be spelled out. My truly legislative assembly could only lay down general rules equally applicable to other, and the other could only curse in enforcing these rules. The second wouldn't have the power to do so, nor would have the first. Now, to preserve this, you would have a third instance, a true constitutional court, which merely decided what the one could do, what the other could do, and what nobody could do. But I think this combination could, in the long run, fully achieve what I aim at, provided that they are elected on quite different principles. I must explain that later. On one condition, that it is really possible, as I believe the 19th century rightly believed it to be possible, to draw sharp logical distinctions between what are general rules of law and what are specific commands. I am not claiming that we have solved all the problems involved there. In fact, that would be the task of my constitutional court, gradually to elaborate this. But the 19th century had actually evolved the definition of a law in the what they called material sense of the word, in contrast to the purely formal sense, as a general rule applicable to an unknown future number of future instances, referring only to individual conduct, one or two more qualifications like this. That in our present knowledge seems to be a pretty adequate definition, although I'm not sure that in practical cases it would always suffice. But that's a typical task of a court. If the principle is laid down, the court can work it out.
As an advocate of a really revolutionary reform in terms of our governmental structure, don't you run the risk of being accused of being a constructionist or a rationalist?
No. I'm quite sure this has to be gradually achieved once the ideal is recognized. And institutions have, of course, to be designed, even if they develop. I only object against the whole thing made to single designed institution. But that our spontaneous order of society is made up of a great many organizations as a technical sense, that within an organization design is needed, and that some degree of design is even needed in the framework within which the spontaneous order operates, I would always concede. I have no doubt about this. I mean, of course, up here against a certain conflict with some of the modern anarchists, but I believe there's one convincing argument why you can't leave even the law to voluntary evolution. The great society depends on your being able to expect that any person you, any stranger you encounter in a given territory will obey the same system of rules of law. Otherwise, you're dealing with people, would be concerned to people, confined to people whom you do know. Mm-hmm. And the conception of some of our modern anarchists that you can have clubs which agree on one law, another club, would make it just impossible to deal with any stranger. So in a sense, you have at least for a given territory a uniform law, and that can only exist if it's enforced by government. So the only qualification you must have is that the law must consist of abstract rules equally applicable to all, referring to an unknown number of future instances and so on.
If the spontaneous order has a beneficial effect on legal institutions, would the United States, for instance, be better off just to abolish the federal government and to have 50 state governments try different institutions?
What I would favor in a case like this is to have a common law in my sense of general rules, but devolve practically all governmental functions to smaller units. When I dream of all governmental functions performed by local units competing with each other for citizens.
You mentioned before that libertarian political movements are springing up in this country and in Europe. What major differences do you perceive between your philosophy and the idea of a spontaneous order and the libertarians who in many cases are near anarchism in their philosophy?
Well, of course, I can't generalize about this because within this large number you have everything from pure anarchists to people who are much too interventionist for me. So I would be somewhere in the middle of that group.
You have written almost alone on the subject in the Constitution of Liberty, the separation of the concept of value and the concept of merit, that good people don't deserve more money, that in the economic system people get money for a lot of reasons that we can't even describe. And this is a subtle point. I don't know if libertarians, even people that agree with your political conclusions, have caught on to this. Do you find that this point is being missed?
I think it has been missed, and I even, when I put it in the Constitution of Liberty, had followed it up to its ultimate conclusions. I think it's all a matter of the basic difference between the attitudes we developed in the close face-to-face society and the modern abstract society. The idea of merit is an idea of our appreciation of known other persons in the small group where what is commonly called a face-to-face society, while in the greater open society, in proparent terms, we must be guided purely by abstract considerations, and merit cannot come in. Incidentally, this is a point which, curious enough, has been seen by Immanuel Kant. He puts it perfectly clearly that he uses the equivalent of merit. Merit cannot be a matter of general rule.
Of course, in society as a whole, the social justice concept is still quite prevalent, and there are even many very popular philosophers who advocate that any sort of good fortune or luck that is economically beneficial to individuals be taxed away.
Well, it's absolutely essential that individuals are making use of luck. And if it's no longer worthwhile to pursue pure luck, very desirable things will be left. I think the whole concept of social justice is a misconception in the sense that a conception which applies to individual conduct only is applied to a spontaneous process which nobody directs. And in fact, the concept is wholly empty because no two people can agree what social justice would be.
What do you make of Alexander Solzhenitsyn's criticism of Western society?
I'm a little puzzled by it. I'm a great admirer of Solzhenitsyn, but my interpretation was just shock by too great a difference between what he had known and was familiar with and what he experiences in the United States. He probably takes many peculiar features of the United States as essential to a free society. I was not greatly impressed by this. In fact, it was a little disillusion in my admiration for Solzhenitsyn when he came out with that statement. Although, in a way, it is a good illustration of one of my main points, that civilization disagrees with a great many of our innate instincts. And most of the people haven't reconciled themselves with that fact, that civilization has certain costs, involves certain constant disappointment on what we call natural needs. Solzhenitsyn is still a man who relies to a great deal on natural instincts. and to discover that so many natural instincts which their advanced civilization does not satisfy oppresses him. So I can understand it, but I don't think his argument is compatible with the argument for a free society.
He is objected, of course, to the hedonism and lack of responsibility that is found in a free society. Is this simply a product of him having very little experience in a free society that this bothers him so much?
Well, it bothers him more, but of course he shares it with so many of our own philosophers that it can't be surprising, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's shocking by a man who has been protesting so loudly against the extreme form of tyranny, but when you reflect upon it, you must almost expect it in his situation, when that he should come to the resignation at which somebody has arrived who has studied for a long time the extent to which to achieve civilization we had to renounce many of our natural instincts. You cannot really expect from a man whose whole concern has been that his natural instincts had been oppressed by that system, but that even civilization requires restraints on natural instincts he has not yet discovered.
Mm-hmm. Looking at the Russian dissidents who certainly face a heroic battle in our time vis-a-vis the concept of liberty, what are you disappointed by the lack of libertarianism in some of their thoughts?
Emotionally, perhaps intellectually not. I understand it too well that this is an almost inevitable situation. I mean, we admire these people for what they dislike, but that they have not a clear idea of what would be desirable is so little surprising that we really ought not to be upset by it. One is naturally upset if a man with whom one has been agreeing all the time then he suddenly turns, like Solzhenitsyn, against Western civilization. It comes as a shock, but in fact, psychologically, nothing is more natural than that.
Of course, it might be disappointing that somebody as brilliant as a Solzhenitsyn has as difficult a time understanding the principles of a liberal society as he does, so that might cause some consternation.
Yes, it naturally does, but you know, when you turn to modern Western literature, there's very little chance of finding a satisfactory explanation of the working of Western society. And I must say I was a little apprehensive when I heard Solzhenitsyn was moving to America and probably getting in the hands of American intellectuals, it means not scholars, but the kind of people of makers of opinion who are fundamentally not the most sensible people you can wish for.
Going back to the intellectual reversion in Western society, let's take a look at Europe. Where do you feel the brightest currents are coming from?
Well, I only know really about three countries now, England, Germany, and France. I think it began really in Germany. It was a very small group at first at the university where I finally taught and now live in Freiburg. And they influenced Erhard, and for a time, in the 50s and 60s, the German, very few, but a group of German intellectuals were leading. There is now a similar development in England, which in a way is perhaps intellectually more founded, largely turning around a single institution, the Institute of Economic Affairs, who has pursued the very sensible policy of not so much talking about general principles, but illustrating them by investigating one particular issue after another in detail. Extremely well done. The French movement is of a very new, recent date. I only learned about it last summer, that there are now a half a dozen young French economists who think like the so-called Austrians in this country and like most of these English people or the Freiburg or so, what do they call it, social market economy school in Germany. And I found this so encouraging because I always felt that the French situation was the most hopeless. And that there should be, from the intellectual end, come a reaction, I think is more promising than almost anything else. I can never generalize about Italy. I don't know what's happening there. There are some extreme individualists and some extreme so-called communists, but both seem, when you analyze it, to be really anarchists. Mm-hmm. Extremes are tush there.
Now, going back to France, the new philosophers, so-called, have received an enormous amount of publicity in France and internationally. What do you perceive their value as?
They're very muddled, really. My hope is for not a nouveau philosophe, a nouveau economiste, which is a distinct group and which, in fact, is criticizing the nouveau philosophes.
On what grounds?
On having still retained much too much of the socialist preconceptions. I mean, the new philosophers are really disappointed with Russia and the Russian doctrine, but still imagine that you can preserve the idealist element behind it and only avoid the excesses of the Communist Party. So fundamentally, they do not think very differently. They are essentially people who have been disillusioned with one idea, but have not yet a clear conception of an alternative. Well, apparently, these new young economists do really believe in a libertarian system.
Why have the liberals lost in Germany? Why are they no longer influential as they once were?
Well, I think it's the usual growth of the parliamentary system in which they realize that with the present type of democracy, government is inevitably driven into intervention even against its professed principles. It's almost a sort of cynicism of people who still believe they it would be nice if we could stick to our liberal principles, but it proves in practice to be impossible. So they resign themselves reluctantly, and perhaps somewhat cynically, well, if other people are getting out things from this process of corruption, let us participate in it. It's quite cynical in some.
Well, so what does a politician do? I mean, you just wrote a foreword for a book by a former Secretary of the Treasury, William Simon, Time for Truth, which became a bestseller in this country, very widely read now. What would a Bill Simon, a Secretary of the Treasury, do under those political constraints?
Well, I'm afraid so long as we retain the present form of unlimited democracy, all you can hope is slow down the process, but they can't reverse it. I'm pessimistic enough to be convinced that unless we change our constitutional structure, we're going to be driven on against people's wishes deeper and deeper into government control. That is in the nature of our political system, which has now become quite as bad as the United States as anywhere else. I mean, what we have got now is in name democracy, but not a system in which it's the opinion of the majority which governs, which merely the government is forced to serve a sufficient number of special interests to get a majority.
Mm-hmm. A political tactic that has just developed very, very recently in this country on the part of libertarians, and Milton Friedman has certainly been a leader here, is this idea of the referendum. The Proposition 13, obviously, was the case in point to allow people as a whole to vote against, in general, big government. And that seems to be the tactic now. Do you think that this really has a...
It's not an ultimate solution, but it may not only delay or slow down the process, it may do even more. It may affect opinion in the right direction. People may come to understand what the trouble is. So I'm all in favor, particularly since I've been watching the thing operating in Switzerland, where again and again, the referendum stopped action which a politician believes they had to take in order to satisfy the majority. And then it turned out when they asked the majority turned it down. It happened so frequently in Switzerland that I am convinced that this is a very useful break on the bad features of our present time democracy. I don't think it's a long time solution, but it might give a sufficiently long pause for the public to appreciate what the dangers are.
You mentioned the Institute for Economic Affairs as having tremendous influence in Britain. Is this really the solution to stimulate intellectual discourse from a free market standpoint?
Well, I'm sure you can't operate any other way. You have to persuade the intellectuals because they are the makers of public opinion. It's not the people who really understand things. It's people who pick up what is fashionable opinion. And you have to make this fashionable opinion amongst the intellectuals before, through journalism and the schools and so on, is spread amongst the people at large. I mean, I oughtn't to praise them because the suggestion of the Institute came from me originally. So I let them on the job, but I'm greatly pleased that they are so successful.
So if a businessman says to you, what can I do to trim the state down? Your suggestion is to send a check to the IEA
or a reasonable
facsimile.
Of course, do the same thing here. I mean, in fact, the man who was founded on my advice, the London Institute, is now creating similar institutes in this country, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, in New York. And he has already done one in Vancouver, which is nearly as good as the London one.
The Fraser Institute, yes. I think you referred to. Earlier this year, the London Times captioned your photograph with the title, F.A. Hayek, the greatest economic philosopher of the age. I dare say that 20 years ago, you would have been given a different title.
Oh, very different, yes.
In your mind, what is the reason for the respect that your ideas are currently garnering when so recently they met with open hostility?
Well, I think the main point is that the decline of the reputation of Keynes. You know, 30 years ago, there were two, you may sound curious myself saying this, but I believe about 1946 when Keynes died, Keynes and I were the best known economists. Then two things happened. Keynes died and was raised to sainthood. And I discredited myself by publishing The Road to Serfdom. And that changed the situation completely. And for the following 30 years, it was only Keynes who counted, and I was gradually almost forgotten. Now, Keynes, the failure of the Keynesian system, the inflation, the return of unemployment, all that, first confirmed my prediction is strictly the economic sphere. At the same time, my studies of politics provided, I believe, answers for many problems which had begun to bother people very seriously. But there is a good reason why I am being rediscovered, so to speak.
Well, if Keynes were alive today, how different do you think the political climate would be?
Like very likely very different. So Keynes was very capable of rapidly changing his opinion. In fact, he was already, when I talked to him last time, very critical of his pupils, who in the post-war period were still agitating for inflation, and assured me that if his ideas would ever become dangerous, he would turn public opinion around in a moment. 6 weeks later, he was dead and couldn't do it. But I wouldn't dare to say what his development would have been. He has been so much an intuitive genius, not really a strict logical reasoner, that both the atmosphere of the time, the needs of the moment, his personal feelings might have swayed his opinions very much. I regard him as a real genius, but not as a great economist, you know. He's not a very consistent or logical thinker. And he might have developed in almost any direction. The only thing I'm sure is that he would have disapproved of what his pupils made of his doctrines.
Joseph Schumpeter's Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy was written just 2 years before your Road to Serfdom.
Yes.
What influence did Schumpeter's book have on you?
None, because my book was practically ready before it came out. See, I rewrote and rewrote for stylistic reasons, but the whole argument was on paper before Schumpeter's book came out.
Are you optimistic about the survival of freedom?
Not very. I think I said so before in this conversation, or at least with one of your predecessors, that if politicians do not destroy civilization next 20 years, there's good hope. But I'm not by no means certain that they shan't succeed in destroying it before then.
So the long run is positive, but the short run looks bleak.
Yes.